Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email or phones. And I'll be giving out those phone numbers in just a few minutes. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. Well, my friends, I've been reading with a bit of alarm an accumulation of stories regarding a compound that's very widely used in the environment, and that's Roundup or glyphosate. A couple of months ago, some stories came out about kidney disease, a sort of epidemic of kidney disease in younger people that was showing up in Central America, India, and Sri Lanka. And one of the things that these areas have in common is a high use of Roundup Ready soybeans and lots of glyphosate being used in the environment. So, you know, that's just epidemiologic data, and there was, and that's interesting, but it's not conclusive. The hypothesis for what's going on is that glyphosate or Roundup has this property of binding heavy metals or binding metals in the soil. And in areas where there's a lot of metal in the soil, these complexes of glyphosate and heavy metals essentially damage the kidney tubules. It overloads the system as the body tries to get rid of the toxin. And so it's acting kind of as a chelating agent. So you can think of it as sort of chelation toxicity. And also it's allowing more heavy metals to get into the people's system. So that's plausible and possible. But again, it's just a hypothesis. So I didn't feel that was worth sharing with you. But a recent study, well, a series of studies actually, are much more worrisome. And this is related to birth defects. And not only does this have a hypothesis and a mechanism, but there's actually substantial data supporting the mechanism. Now, all the way back in the 1980s, there were, Monsanto knew that high doses of glyphosate cause malformation in experimental animals, but you can make the argument that humans won't be exposed to high doses, so not a problem. But since 1993, there's been data that even low doses can cause malformations. And the malformations we're talking about are absent kidneys, absent lungs, enlarged hearts, abnormally formed spine and skull, particularly things like spina bifida and open spinal cords. There's been epidemiologic evidence in Latin America, increases, again, like we talked about with the kidney disease, increases of birth defects in areas where there's heavy glyphosate use, higher incidences of spina bifida, abnormal ears, cleft palate, polycystic kidney, extra fingers and toes. And the interesting thing about those is that that's a pattern, okay? And that's a pattern that we see with vitamin A toxicity. So some researchers in Argentina actually went studying this, and they experimented with frog and chicken embryos and showed that the herbicide does cause significant malformations. And they proved that what Roundup does is it increases the signaling of vitamin A. So it's important to understand there are vitamin A is a fat-soluble vitamin present in the environment, and we know that as vitamins go, it's one of the ones with the lowest therapeutic window. In other words, you can easily take overdoses of vitamin A that will cause birth defects. And in fact, there are cautions out there about vitamin A supplementation in women of childbearing ages, because we know if you get as little as 24,000 units a day, that can trigger cleft palate and spinal cord abnormalities in the fetus. Well, that's a little bit scary. As I said, you could actually achieve those doses with over-the-counter supplements, well, we've all known about that for a long time, but we're not so worried about it because the doses are high. But what if we were to amplify that signaling, which is what Roundup does, effectively turning a low dose of vitamin A into the physiologic signal that a high dose of vitamin A does by basically inducing this system and making it more sensitive to the vitamin A that's present in the diet. Now, the reason I'm sharing this with you now is that I learned recently that the EPA will be reviewing Roundup at the end of this year and deciding whether or not to impose restrictions or maybe even ban it altogether, or at least put limitations on its use. After I've reviewed this evidence, my friends, I'm really convinced that this needs to happen. And so I encourage you to do some searching, educate yourselves, and if you agree with me, then consider writing to the EPA in support of restrictions on Roundup. Because I really do think that we've got enough evidence now that we need to back away from the widespread use of this agent. The key thing is to understand when you're doing harm and react to it. Our next story was triggered by another recent flurry in the news talking about prostate cancer screening and whether or not it should be done for all. There was a major study published in the last week or so in The Lancet, and that got a lot of people talking. Richard Alban, the doctor who actually developed PSA testing, has been on record for a very long time saying this was not developed as a cancer screening tool. This was developed to monitor cancer therapy, and he has never approved of its use as a widespread cancer screen for a lot of reasons. What's this controversy about? Well, it's about whether or not we are doing more harm than good. Now, I stopped using PSAs in my physicals and routine screening about a year and a half ago because, well, I'll give you a couple of aphorisms. The Hippocratic Oath says, first, do no harm, and the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So let's migrate that into my current philosophy, which is, since I can't be sure that I'm not doing harm, let me at least do less harm than good. And if I can't be sure I'm doing less harm than good, then I need to re-examine what I'm doing. In the case of PSA screening, the average low-risk male, that is to say no family history of prostate cancer, has about a 3% chance of dying from prostate cancer as his cause of death. If you screen with PSA, you can reduce that risk from 3% to 2.4%. Not a real substantial drop. But the cost of screening all those healthy males for prostate cancer is that you're going to find a lot of harmless prostate cancer that wouldn't cause any trouble, that wouldn't hurt the person because they'd die of something else before that cancer killed them. And the problem there is that once we find the prostate cancer, we've done harm. If we decide to just sit there and watch it, watchful waiting, we've generated a lot of anxiety and existential angst on the part of the patient. If we decide to treat it, we're possibly, in certain cases, certainly going to cause impotence, bladder incontinence, and of course, expense, exposure to radiation, all sorts of injury in our goal to improve survival. But statistically, we know that we haven't really made a substantial dent in survival. So the question is all this expense and intervention worth it in an era of, well, having to think about being cost-effective, having to make sure that we have enough money to cure those hepatitis C cases? Do we really need to treat the prostate cancers that don't matter anyway? And this is what we struggle with in medicine. So at the moment, I think it's up to you. You are taking a risk to be tested in that you may find something that won't matter in the long run, but that you'll have to deal with. On the other hand, if you're one of the unlucky ones who gets a really aggressive prostate cancer and you lose the opportunity to find it early, maybe there would have been a survival benefit for you. at this point in medicine, we are debating this and trying to figure out what's the best move. There's a lot of uncertainty in medicine. And like I said, my attitude is try to do less harm than good. We had an off-air comment. I read that you need to cook kale to get any health benefit. Is it true? Yes, I saw this recently as well, and I went looking for the source of the meme because it was all over the internet last week. Couldn't really find much science. So I'll keep looking for the article at Google Scholar or in where the actual physiology of this is depicted. But for the moment, I'm going to say that those of you who are doing your, have managed to make kale yummy and are using it raw in shakes, I wouldn't change my behavior just on the basis of this meme. I'm not sure it's got the data to back it up. And we're going to talk to Sandra in Monterey. Hello, Sandra. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question regarding gallbladder surgery. My mom had a gallstone attack and was hospitalized over in Massachusetts. And I don't have a ton of details, but what it comes down to is she was pretty much getting answers that the automatic first step is to remove the gallbladder, which she's less than pleased about. And she says her brother, who lives in Poland, had a surgery where all they did was remove the gallstones that were causing the pain.
Well, without knowing a lot more detail about your mom's situation, it's really hard to second-guess the recommendation. But in general, if a person has asymptomatic gallstones, and we just find them, we're doing an ultrasound, we just find them, and they aren't having gallbladder attacks, then we leave well enough alone, with the exception of a diabetic. And if you're diabetic, we take them out because diabetics get gallbladder gangrene when they get cholecystitis, and that'll give you sepsis and kill you. So we don't mess around with the diabetics with gallstones. Secondly, if you get a gallbladder attack, let's say when you're pregnant, we don't like to do unnecessary surgery on pregnant ladies. So we give people a drug called ursodiol, which is actually bear bile, basically. And it's a very powerful form of solvent for gallstones. And if people are taking this orally, their gallstones will melt. And so as long as they're on the drug, they no longer get gallbladder attacks. And in people who are severely debilitated or who just really don't want the surgery, ursodiol taken long-term is A, safe, and B, effective, and C, almost never recommended in this country for reasons that are cultural rather than scientific. Now, it is the standard of care in this country to remove the gallbladder after you've had even a single gallstone attack. And so,
yeah, this is her first attack, and she's neither diabetic nor pregnant.
Yeah,
she's a smoker and not in generally great health.
She's getting the party line. How old did you say she was?
She's about 55.
Okay, so she's a smoker, but she isn't 95, so she's not a high-risk surgery patient. As surgeries go, it's the laparoscopic gallbladder surgeries have very low morbidity, very low mortality. Essentially, your risk is the anesthesia risk for the most part. Rarely a person has to have an open procedure. Essentially, if there's an oops and, you know, things happen, things happen. There's a blood vessel in a place where you didn't see it. It gets cut. Suddenly you have a hemorrhage. You have to open and control the bleeding. That's a really, really rare event, but it's on the table. In general, I think it's a fairly straightforward thing. And as I said, it is the standard of care in this country, but I'm not, and it's probably true that it's not the standard of care in Poland because I doubt they have quite the prevalence. I doubt they have quite as many surgeons in Poland, which really is what it boils down to.
So, now, what about some of the recommendations for things I was finding on the internet? Drinking like apple cider vinegar mixed with water, and cutting a lot of the fats out of her diet, or any of those sorts of recommendations.
Well, you know, in other countries where you have to wait for your gallbladder surgery because there's effectively time rationing by time. Here we ration by money and insurance policy, but in other countries, they just everybody gets in line. What you do is you put people on a low-fat diet, exactly, because it's when you eat fat that your gallbladder contracts, and that's when the stones get stuck in the duct and cause the pain. So you eat a low-fat diet. The apple cider vinegar olive oil technique, I've had people tell me that they pass their gallstones. I've never actually had an occasion to check the before and after ultrasounds. I'd love to see some. If anybody has got some actual, you know, has done this who out there who wants to call in and, you know, hand me their before the apple cider and olive oil ultrasound and then the post that shows that the gallstones are gone, I would just love to see some proof because I would love it to be true. But okay. Right now I have to say that there's plenty of true believers out there. There's a lot of stuff on the internet. But there's a lot of stuff on the internet. You know what I mean?
Well, right, yeah.
So internet lore doesn't move me except to say, maybe I'll go look in Google Scholar and see if there's any data. I did search that one, couldn't find anything.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, well, I will let her know. Can you give me the name of the Bear Bile drug one more time?
Ursodiol. U-R-S-O-D-I-O-L.
Got it. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Let's go to Dale in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dale. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
You know, I was listening to your comments on Roundup, and I have a friend who's living up in North Dakota right now, and she was talking with an organic wheat farming family, and this has been going on for generations. They are now being encouraged to use Roundup to hasten the ripening of the wheat because prices are being controlled by the oil industry and the fracking to the point where they have control of the cars, the railroad cars, and they can't even get their wheat to market on time.
Oh, wow.
It's a scary thing.
Wow, that is interesting.
Yeah, and I just heard this last night, and I was like, oh, my God, this is really scary. I went up to North Dakota last summer for the state fair, and they had a big sign up proudly stating, you know, we provide more than 2 million loaves of bread to this country every year.
And I think that is something to be proud of, but I also think that the idea that that industry, that the oil industry is doing some kind of a, are you implying that it's a conspiracy to sell more Roundup?
Well, not a conspiracy, but the farmers up there are using Roundup.
Okay.
And to kill the crop so that it hastens the ripening so they can get their wheat to market at a decent price.
And what's the motivation of the oil companies here?
They control the railroad cars that would usually be carrying wheat.
And so the timing factor. Why does the timing matter if they control how's that work?
Well, I guess that there's times when there are railroad cars available, and there are times when that can be used for wheat. But most of the train space now is being taken up by the fracking industry.
Okay.
And the natural gas that's being
all
harvested.
Right. So it's okay. So it's resource competition.
Yeah.
And okay, I'm still having a little trouble with the logic. It's very interesting comment.
Yeah. I haven't even had much time to get beyond just the phone call of this from last night and go, I mean, this is really serious in the big picture.
If it's true, and if it's not a misinterpretation, but I think that the law of unintended consequences here, and what you're saying is, okay, this competition for resources exists, and it's certainly not a direct, it's an indirect consequence of fracking, which we all disagree with on, I think, on general principle that we have, water is, well, you know, there may be somebody listening who feels that the trade-off is valid. You know, it's clearly a risk-benefit trade-off. I'm of the opinion that the in the next century, water, clean water is going to be the most precious resource.
Exactly.
And I would say that the Bush the Bush family agrees with me. They own the water rights to Uruguay, all of it, all of the water rights, and the concept that we are messing with water. In order to get oil, so we're trading essentially future water for current oil, strikes me as a very, very short-sighted practice. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who agree with me and probably some who disagree. But anyway, this sort of fits in there and the creepiness about fracking.
Right.
But, you know, I think it's an important, you've made an interesting point. I do think it needs to be thought through and validated a little bit just on, you know, just to be fair.
Oh, sure, sure.
But
sure.
Thanks.
I just wanted to sort of get this information to someone.
Well, you got it out.
Yeah. Oh, and, you know, the organic farmer did say that they are seeing increased cases of leukemia in children up there.
There is definitely a cancer glyphosate connection too that's been reported, but the thing that really got me excited about this was that they had established and demonstrated an actual mechanism.
Uh-huh.
And when you've got a good mechanism and you prove that you upregulate vitamin A pathway, and so you show that, and we know that that pathway causes these sorts of birth defects, and we see these sorts of birth defects in high utilization areas, that starts to look like a very good case, you know, for the prosecution, so to speak.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you.
One more thing, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You know, I went up there last summer, and I drove around in this area where major fracking is being done. And, I mean, the earth just looks like it has been plowed, you know, under, and there's huge stacks of truck cars where the workers are living inside of these truck cars. And
boom towns, yeah. I've heard about them.
Plumes of natural gas going up into the air, and it's one of the saddest sights I ever saw. And that area is connected then to, well, by the water, Lake Sakakawea. And Lake Sakakawea is dammed, and it goes then on into the Missouri River. It's actually part of the Missouri River, which then goes into Mississippi. And our water rights are definitely being trampled.
Well, thank you for your comments, and I hope that this will spur some of our audience to increased activism.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. We're going now to Heidi in Palo Colorado Canyon. Hello, Heidi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You can hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so I have a really interesting question here that I haven't heard you cover yet, but it has to do with Medicare patients being admitted to the hospital or not admitted to the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Short stay observation.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I had read an article about this, and it sounded from this article that it had to do with the hospital. But yesterday I got a call from a social worker, and my elderly father was admitted because he had fallen, and he's being treated for, he has bronchitis, and he's also dehydrated, and so they want him to have physical therapy when he's out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I was told by the social worker that every day a caseworker and the physician go over his case or anybody's case and decide whether they're under observation or actually, I don't know what you'd call it, an admitted patient.
Admitted.
And it goes back and forth, or it can go back and forth. And so he may or may not have to pay for the observation, and it may not add up to the 3 days where he can be transferred to a different facility and have that paid for. So what's going on here?
Well, can you say Byzantine rules?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the start. And yes, it is about 10 years since this observation status started to emerge. And there are regulations from Health and Human Services that I don't understand very well. And so I'm going to get into trouble here, and I want to be sure that I don't give false information. But if there's a decision point at the onset where a person is thought that maybe they're going to be okay and we're going to send them home tomorrow, and so we're not allowed to, in these low acuity situations where, you know, some classic little old lady comes in with chest pain, you check her out, she looks fine, EKG looks fine, troponin looks fine, but she's 82 years old and lives alone and is a little frail, and you don't want to send her home. So you say, all right, we'll keep her overnight under observation. And in the morning, if her EKG still looks good and her enzymes haven't bumped, then we'll send her home. And so that would be a classic observation situation, or a fall and a faint, where, again, you just aren't sure what's going on and you don't want to get in trouble, send the person home and have them have a bad outcome because you missed something. So I think the intention initially was good. And the thing about Medicare is that many years ago, perhaps 20 years ago, Medicare switched the way they paid hospitals so that they paid by the diagnosis, not by the day. And because they thought hospitals were keeping patients too long. And so they said, well, for pneumonia, community-acquired pneumonia with no other comorbidities, we're going to give you we're going to allow 3 days. And that's all you're going to get paid for. If the person stays for 7 days because they're homeless and you can't get them out of the hospital, too bad, your problem, not ours. And that was a way of pushing back at the hospitals for what they felt was a type of not being proactive enough, not putting enough resources into getting people home. And, you know, back 25 years ago, hospitals were getting bigger and bigger and more and more beds, and people were kind of sitting around to those beds, and you were getting paid like a motel fee for every day you kept the people in the beds. So there was a financial incentive to hold on to patients. So Medicare tried to fix that. And then what happened with the DRGs was that you would admit people who were marginal. What happened was that there were hospitals that started admitting more marginal cases, and, you know, to fill the beds. And then they would get the DRG payment, but those people were not really that sick, and they could go home in a day. So they got paid for 3 days, but they only kept the patient for a day. So then Medicare came back and said, no, you can't do that. These low acuity cases have to be held on an observation status. And then after a while, if they're really sick and you can't send them home in 24 hours, then you get to convert them to an admission, and we'll retroactively convert it to an admission and pay you your DRG.
Oh, my God.
All right. Now, okay, that's what I know about it. This thing about jumping back and forth from OBS to inpatient status, that's a new one on me. And I'm not sure if that exists in all the states or...
Yeah, this was Illinois, but I was told that this was something from Medicare and that there were a strict set of criteria.
Yeah. Yeah. They are, and they get inspected on this, and they go through the chart and they look at acuity, and you know there's always, whenever there's an incentive, people will find how to make that economic incentive work for them. And you know, I just had a comment from my producer making sure I said that, you know, in the days of DRGs, they were sending, you know, they would send people home too soon. And then people, you know, because if you can get them out quicker and you're getting paid for 3 days, then get them out quicker. But then, of course, people would come back into the hospital because they weren't well enough to have gone home, and so they would bounce back in. And so Medicare started fining for that practice. So now it's just this real push-pull dynamic with inspectors with clipboards and people who are trying to keep their jobs, and also the poor patient who's stuck in the middle.
Right.
And, you know, it's just not pretty. The people do really get the short end of the stick sometimes because they're kept under observation for several days, but so they don't qualify for home health, which is the thing. You have to be an admitted patient for 3 days before you qualify for home health.
Right.
And that's expensive. And if you need to go to a nursing home or a facility like that, Medicare won't pay for it unless you've been in the hospital for 3 days.
And DRG stands for?
Diagnostic Related Group.
Okay. that is one of those bureaucratic terms. Huh?
Yeah, and there are people who have made their entire careers on both sides of this, in the hospital side and the in the Medicare side. They're Medicare experts. They're sort of like, a lawyer who specializes in patent law, or there's whole industries of people who specialize in Medicare minutiae and fight back and forth. We have a lot of resources that are going into trying to save money. I recently tweeted that I think it's just possible that if we stopped spending so much money trying to save money, we might actually save money.
You know, that was my thought, because as this woman went over all of the details, it seemed like there were so many people involved that didn't need to be involved that it was very expensive.
So many people getting paid. You know,
yes.
Plus benefits, health insurance, yes. Their own health insurance, their retirement, and you know, these are good, solid middle class jobs we're talking
right.
about. So they don't. This time doesn't come cheaply, and
yeah.
it's
so. Is yeah. there anything that a patient can do while they're there? I mean, ask. I don't know.
All hospitals have to have an ombudsman. So this is basically the person who's supposed to act as the patient advocate.
Okay.
And that's where you want to start is, you know, who's your Medicare ombudsman? I want to talk to them.
All right.
Sometimes just calling, you know, yes, that introduces another adversarial thing in, but at least you've got somebody in your corner.
All right.
I know. It's an adversarial situation rather than a collaborative and cooperative one, which is what it should be. But then again, it's been like that for a very long time. I don't expect it to get better.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry to be cynical.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. And we're going to take a call from Judy in Monterey right now. Hello, Judy, and welcome to the program.
Hi. Nice to talk to you, and I always listen on Saturdays. It's a real treat. I just wanted to mention on the observation status, the hospital is obligated to tell the patient, you know, on admission what their status is and what expenses will be incurred. Now, frequently this doesn't happen, or if you're a little old lady, you know, you might not get what they're saying. I think they're getting better at it, but still not 100%.
Are they required to do this in writing or verbally?
Writing.
All
and
right.
It needs to be on the chart. So if you go into the emergency room, at the point at which they decide you're going to be observation or inpatient, then they need to talk to you and have you sign this paper saying they've explained it to you. And when you get your Medicare bill, you will notice there's a paragraph on it now that addresses this directly and basically says if you were not advised, you should notify Medicare. The other thing is that when you go in on observation status, you're responsible for the Part B Medicare thing.
Which is 20% of the hospital bill.
And the drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the drugs are the main thing. So.
So essentially, the smart move is to be sick enough to qualify for admission.
Right. And to know that it makes a difference,
right.
You know. I did experience this myself last year. I had what I think they thought was a heart attack, but it turned out to be a migraine. And I actually went to the ER. No one told me, but I ended up in a monitored room in a hospital bed. So, you know, on a floor. So I thought, inpatient, you know, I'm a nurse. Anyway, but, you know, then when I stayed 24 hours, went home, and then I got a bill for all the drugs they had given me.
What was your bill for? How much was it?
Well, you know, one dose of Advair was $548. The Tylenol and the, you know, the other ones were pretty reasonable, not exactly. The only thing I didn't get charged for was the IV, the Keep Open IV.
It was
interesting. I think I ended up owing them $1,800, which I disputed, and I got, I think, about $200 back, but not much. I didn't report it to Medicare.
Well, thank you very much for that information. We'll try.
And, you know, when I went to my doctor And I said to him, why did you keep me in observation? Which was inappropriate, I think, given the circumstances. He said he had no idea patients ended up paying for their meds.
Oh, honey, we're not clued into prices of anything. There's a huge conspiracy on the part of all of the industry to keep doctors completely in the dark about the prices of the things we order, because we would be shocked and appalled if we knew.
Right.
Whenever I actually look into the prices of things, I am, and I do a lot because of the nature of my practice now, I'm just absolutely flabbergasted at what the charges are for these very simple things.
This kind of surfaced down here in Monterey about, I think, probably about 12 months ago. There were several letters to the editor, mostly children on the behalf of parents, elderly parents who had been hospitalized and then got a bill. So,
well,
and I think, you know, this observation thing, from what I understand, it has been in effect for quite a while, maybe 3-4 years. But Medicare just recently really started, you know, enforcing it and auditing it and that kind of thing.
Yes, so. There has definitely been a sea change in terms of this, but I presume it's because some policy changed somewhere. It's probably an unintended consequence of Obamacare, would be my guess, because a whole lot of things changed in 2012 when that was passed.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your insight and personal sharing. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye bye.
Take care.
We had an off-air question I wanted to be sure to get to. And that was someone saying, hey, if PSAs are unreliable, what's a poor guy to do? And the answer is probably digital rectal exam is at the moment. And what I would love to see would be prostate MRIs, which are an excellent way to identify lesions. And that would be, you know, what I would love to do would be PSA on everybody, MRI on any elevated PSA, check it again 3 months later. If you see interval growth, then that's when you biopsy, because that one's looking aggressive. We should be able to find ways with all of this sophisticated imaging we have of identifying the more aggressive tumors just on the basis of their physiology. Also, I think the tumor markers, the urine tests, and other things for looking for the proteins that are seen and identified in aggressive prostate tumors, I think that's really just around the corner. So I really expect technology to come riding to the rescue, and I'm hoping that it does so in a way that isn't too expensive. I'm an advocate for nationalizing the, or nationalizing is the wrong word. I'm an advocate for making MRIs a public resource by simply setting up statewide MRI centers to use for screening, for example, for breast cancer in women with dense breasts, to use for this sort of thing where you're trying to figure out about prostate cancers. I'd like them to be cheap and widely available rather than expensive. And if the states, as part of the state healthcare system, had the MRIs and created essentially local centers where you would drive maybe 150 miles to get your MRI, but oh well. So you take a day off and you do the drive. But instead of $2,000 or $3,000 for the MRI, we could get the cost down to something on the order of a regular routine x-ray. That would start to really transform medicine and really save money. And I think it would be a great thing to think about. This was actually part of the things that were on the table when California was going to do its own health system. That was, of course, vetoed a long time ago by the governor, but nevertheless, a lot of good ideas came out of that discussion. And I've always wanted to continue advocacy for that one, because I think that could be a real transformer. Let's go to Bob in Santa Cruz now, and Bob has a question about screening. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Dr. Dunn.
Hey, what can I do for you today?
I just got a question. I kind of been out of the medical system for about, 10 or 12 years. You know,
how old are you, Bob?
57.
Okay, you're a typical guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, I've just been doing, you know, acupuncture and chiropractic care. I had a daughter. I didn't even give her any immunizations because, you know, I saw just all kinds of crazy information about negative side effects. So I'm kind of I try to be aware and on top of stuff, and I don't just take, you know, the regular status quo medical advice because I try to be more smart about it. But I just recently got, a Medi-Cal through Obamacare, and I went to the doctor the other day, and I was blown away. I mean, the guy wants to give me a colonoscopy, he wants to give me a prostate exam, he wants to do lab work, he wants to update all my vaccinations that I haven't gotten. It's like, you know, I just feel like, it's like, you know, what do I do? You know, how important is some of this stuff? I mean, I had a colonoscopy when I was 40, but what are you going to do? Get a colonoscopy every year? You know, I don't even know why I want to do that. And I have I was doing a cleanse, and I had someone what do they do when they give you an enema, but, you know, it's more like, you know, where they push the water up, and she was saying that could be dangerous. And so I'm not really sure, you know, what to do with any of this stuff. But I'm even against getting lab work done. So I was hoping I could get a little advice from you.
Okay. Well, let's start with just a broad thing. There's a thing called the U.S. Preventative Health Services Task Force, which is a very conservative body, very evidence-based. And you can go and look. You can just look up recommendations, you know, U.S. Preventative Services, male, age 57, and you'll get a whole list of things, and there'll be a category A to a category C in terms of how important this very conservative body thinks they should be. And when I say conservative, I mean they don't do anything that really shouldn't be done. And they're basing it on large amounts of data, saying, okay, what's going to keep people alive? What's going to make a real difference in unnecessary death? And, of course, the thing your doctor is doing is pretty much following a playbook that we've all been handed, which says that if this is your patient and they get this disease on your watch and you haven't and you're not on paper as recommending that they do these things, then from the standpoint of a lawsuit, you might as well have given them the cancer because you didn't screen for it. And that's the toxic meme that the doctor's walking around with in his or her head is, right. Oh my God, I've got to do all these tests. I've got to make sure that everybody gets them. And if they haven't gotten them, or I've got to at least be able to show that I told them they really needed them, because otherwise it's my fault. And right. So there's that going on. There's also the fact that a lot of these are genuinely legitimate things to do. If you don't want your patients to have an early morbidity, and they're going on a fishing expedition in a healthy 57-year-old guy, you're supposed to have a colonoscopy every 10 years or do poop cards every single year. For it ongoing, and if you have any positive stool, any blood in the poop cards, then you're supposed to get a colonoscopy and look to see to make sure there's not a colon cancer. Your lifetime risk of colon cancer is about 1 in 15 without a family history, and that's one of the cancers we love to find because we can cure it when we find it early. That's not true of a lot of other cancers, and
there's a poop card that you would do that could detect it.
Yeah, you can do poop cards every year. Doctors don't like them because we don't trust people like you. We don't trust 57-year-old healthy guys to show up next year and do their poop cards. And so unless you've got a real track record with a doctor, or the doctor's a maverick like myself who figures that you're a free agent and you can make your own decisions, we don't like poop cards. We feel a lot happier with the colonoscopy because then we're off the hook for the next 10 years and so are you. But yes, there are complications to colonoscopies. Perforations do occur. They are rare. They are not but the perforation rate is somewhere around, depending on whose data you look at, 1 in 1,000 cases to 1 in 5,000 cases. So, you know, that's not a very big risk, but it's not negligible either. The prostate exam. Get the prostate exam. Come on, don't be silly. Let him feel your prostate for lumps. Okay, that's easy. The lab work that I would say is kind of a minimum thing. You want to look at your inflammatory markers. You want to look at your liver enzymes. If you've never been checked for Hep C, get checked for Hep C, because that should be done in everybody in your age group.
I've been checked for that.
All right, good. Then you're done there. In terms of vaccinations, my attitude is if you garden or play in the dirt, then you probably should have a tetanus booster every 10 years. And I'm not worried about causing problems in adults unless they've had an allergic reaction, which is quite rare. Do you flu shots in 57-year-olds? I can take or leave them. I don't think it's that mission critical.
I'm not going to do that.
What else would be recommended? You know, I can't really think of anything that's mission critical beyond the tetanus. You certainly don't have to have a measles booster or anything like that, unless we end up in an epidemic, then you might want one. Basic blood count to look for anemia, because if you're anemic, then we really do need to chase the colon cancer. A poop card, 3 sets of Hemocult cards to FecaSure is the best one. It looks for a enzymatic reaction that's only seen with human blood, so you won't get fooled by cow's blood. Those are good. I would do those. I can understand being a little overwhelmed by all of the things that your doctor wants to do. But on the other hand, you haven't been to a doctor for a very, very long time. And at 57, you've kind of reached the use-by date on the perfectly healthy, no problems thing.
My warranty's expired.
When I got my Prius, I got 100,000 miles or 10 years, whichever came first, something like that. And that was great. Ran off the edge of that cliff a long time ago. But when you're out of warranty, there's a reason for that. And that's because the statistics for Toyota say that after 100,000 miles, it's probably something going to go wrong with this car. We'd rather not be on the hook for it. Statistically, after 50, there's a high enough probability of you having a cancer or having a substantial amount of heart disease or having diabetes, you know, all the things that we start looking for that start happening, hypertension. There's a good enough bet that you've got something that it's worth doing. It's worth looking, because a lot of these things will shorten your life and kill you. And if we find them, we can fix them or prevent the shortening of your life.
Well, my dad's 87. He's perfectly healthy. My grandfather lived till 88. My grandmother lived till 97. I exercise regularly. I eat healthy. I'm fit as a fiddle. And, something good happened, but it seems like it's like, what are you going to do? Every year you're going to be taking, you know, getting probed and punctured and checked everything out. I mean, as long as you don't have family history, it seems like it's kind of like...
I think you're making this very black and white, and you already know what you're going to do. But my recommendation here, let me first give you permission to be a free agent. Let me tell you that it would be very nice and polite if you would formally refuse in writing to your doctor and saying, you know, thank you very much for your suggestion, Dr. Jones. I've decided that I'm not going to do any of these things, but I acknowledge that you told me I should. That will make the doctor feel better. Because you heard him, and you decided not to go there, and that's it's your funeral or your success, but it's not his fault.
He was kind of shocked when I was rejecting all his proposals.
And that's fine. That's understandable. He's swimming in that sea, and so if you don't want to swim in that ocean, that's fine. you've got, you know, there's sharks in the ocean you're choosing to swim in. So
I'll do the blood work. That sounds like something that might be worth on a simple
visit. Do the blood work. I'd also say, you know, let somebody feel your prostate. But I know you may draw the line at that. Men are very protective
area. I've had that done before. It's just, you know.
It's really not a big deal.
How often do you do that? Like every 5 years or something?
Depends on how often you go to the doctor. After 50, he's probably going to want to do it annually, but you can refuse. Anyway, you poop stuff out bigger than that finger every day, I hope. All right, have a good time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We had an off-air question. How many doses of hydrocodone leads to addiction? And I wanted to address that because it's showing a common misconception about addiction. So let me just say that a person who is taking narcotics for pain does not necessarily get addicted to narcotics. We don't define addiction as going through withdrawal. That's physiological adaptation. And if you're in pain and you only take your narcotics to alleviate your pain so that you can live through it, you don't necessarily become psychologically addicted to where you're going to use that drug and take more and more and be inappropriate and go out and buy street drug. You're not necessarily after the high. The addiction is where you are using the drug inappropriately, not just to control your pain, but perhaps to control emotional pain or to distance yourself from life or to get a buzz. And when that happens, there's a reward pathway in the brain that involves dopamine that gets attached here. And it's the same part of the brain that lights up in gambling addiction or in sex addiction or in food addiction. It's a different part of the reward path. It's a reward pathway. And once it gets programmed, and there are definitely genetic predispositions that certain people are born with, but once that gets programmed, then that's addiction. And people will do very strikingly inappropriate things, break the law, lie, cheat, steal to get that agent or get that fix, to get that little burst of dopamine in the reward pathway. So the answer is there is no number of pills of hydrocodone that creates addiction. In terms of physiologic adaptation, it's highly variable. A lot of people can be on a fixed dose of lower doses of hydrocodone, up to say 30 milligrams a day for many years without ever needing to increase the dose. Others will start to adapt out at about 3 months and require higher and higher doses. A lot of times it depends on how severe the pain is, but it also depends on a lot of other variables, some of them cognitive, some of them psychological, and some of them situational, that with respect to what the pain driver is that influences all of this. So a very simple question with a very complex answer. We're going to try to get in one last call, and that's Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank. We don't have much time, but I thought I'd give it a shot.
Hi. Could ferritin go to zero? How would you know it? And would there be any bad results from it?
Okay. Ferritin is a protein that's made in the liver that does a couple of things. One of the things it does is act as a storage protein to hold on to iron in the bloodstream, and we use the level of ferritin to indicate whether or not a person is iron deficient, although there are better tests. Another thing ferritin does is it goes up when there's an infection or inflammation, and so that's one of the group of things we call acute phase reactants. Other things that are like that are your sed rate and your C-reactive protein, your gamma globulin. These will all go up in the presence of an infection as well. So I have never seen a ferritin of zero. And if I saw a ferritin of zero, I would probably assume it was a lab error. So I don't think it can go to zero. It could go very low and maybe be listed as undetectable. But again, I've never actually seen that on a lab test I've looked at, but I suppose it's possible. I would worry about liver function first in that setting.
A grand explanation. Thank you again.
Well, you're very welcome, and have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we've got anything quick. This is a new marker coming out. Small RNAs in the blood may be the next test for heart injury. Currently, we use a test called troponin, which is a protein that is in heart muscle cells. It's supposed to be inside of the cells, and when the cells are injured, they leak the troponin. The problem is that there's a bit of a delay in that, and lots of times we have to, when the heart's been injured, you'll have a negative troponin initially, and then 8 to 12 hours later, it'll turn positive. That's why we keep those people overnight under OBS. It might be able to avoid admitting those patients for observation if we had a test that was going to be positive close to immediately. And researchers have profiled small microRNAs circulating in the blood, and new research coming out of Rockefeller University suggests that these tests may be able to diagnose heart injury virtually immediately and also differentiate between ischemic heart injury and heart failure, which would make it really, really nice, because currently troponin goes up in both heart failure and heart attack. And of course, many older people have a little bit of elevated troponin from heart failure, and they don't need to be admitted. These microRNAs might allow us to split the difference, so to speak, and know who we could send home and who we have to admit. So thought that was kind of a nice coincidence that dovetailed nicely with our discussions earlier about short stay observation and the issues that creates. No, we've come to the end of the hour, and I've enjoyed it. I hope that my callers got answers they wanted and the listeners got information they could use. Remember, you can always listen to segments of this program on the website, AskDrDawn.com. We put a lot of effort into breaking it up so you can just listen to small segments of the show that interest you rather than having to listen to the whole thing. Of course, I do encourage that. Anyway, I want to encourage you all to get out and walk around, have a beautiful week, eat something healthy, and get some exercise. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.